This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello, welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I am Chinedu Ofor, and here's what's coming up.
Teachers are being persecuted every day, every hour. Some have been brutally killed. Others brutally deprived of some parts of their bodies. Forced out of their areas to become internally displaced persons.
That was Peter Tai, spokesperson for demonstrating teachers, who says instructors working in Cameroon's conflict zones endure a lot of suffering. All this and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. For years, Russia has been expanding its influence in Africa using mercenaries with the notorious Wagner Group in at least 10 countries to back dictators in return for natural resources and political clout. Wagner's deployment has provided Moscow leverage on a continent where it has historically had little presence. Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, discussed with VOA senior analyst Mohamed Elshenawy how Russia used the cover of Wagner as a private military contractor to penetrate Africa and derail democratic transitions in some countries.
I think Wagner has been a useful tool for Moscow because it can offer Wagner as a solution to security challenges that African countries are facing, especially among isolated leaders who are facing a growing security challenge. Bringing in mercenaries seems like a reasonable thing to do, but I think that's where there's a misunderstanding. Wagner is not really there to solve the security challenges that these countries face. Rather, their primary motivations are to help prop up individual leader or regime, and secondly, to help expand Russia's influence. So, nowhere that Wagner has been deployed, whether in Africa or elsewhere, has it brought stability. So instead, its primary aims are more political in nature.
So where in Africa did Russia manage to use the Wagner Group to reap political and economic gains?
Well, there's some 8 to 12 countries where Wagner has been involved in different ways. The most prominent of these are in Libya and Central African Republic, Mozambique, Madagascar, Sudan, Guinea-Bissau, and now there's discussions of an increased Wagner presence in Mali. And I think it's important to recognize that it's usually not just the security element of Wagner that gets deployed, but this is usually accompanied by different political support, whether it be disinformation, personal protection for that leader, and there might be arms for resources types of deals. So it tends to be a bigger package of deals than simply a security arrangement.
How did Russia's attempt to influence Africa's governance derail the transition to democracy in some African countries?
I think we need to consider the way that Russia has been engaging in Africa. And it's notable in that it isn't following a classic bilateral relationship approach where it tries to invest in economic development and strengthen its diplomatic relations, provide some broader security cooperation, all on official level. What Russia has been doing and the way it's been gaining influence has often been unofficial and often undeclared means, such as the deployment of mercenaries, disinformation, election meddling. And these are all things that Russia denies doing. So they're very much happening under the radar, but they're usually wrapped up in an effort to prop up an individual leader. I call it elite capture, where they're working often with an isolated leader, typically who's not democratically elected, and in that way, making that leader beholden to Moscow, and therefore redirecting the sort of democratic processes in a country. And so, we've seen that in places that have been more democratic, such as Guinea and Central African Republic. But I think, we could also point to other transitions that have been underway, like in Libya, where, the electoral process there is very much going to be beholden to what Russia's interests are. The transition in Sudan, Russia is very active in trying to support the military government there. Clearly, Russia has been involved in Mali, from the time of Ibrahim Keita, and sort of fomenting some of the popular unrest that led to his toppling through the military coup, and now Russia's support for the coup there. So there are any number of examples where Russia has been involved in derailing the democratic transition process in Africa.
That was Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, speaking with VOA Senior Analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi. Ethiopia says the UN can replace seven of its humanitarian officials who were expelled, but the global body says it has no plans to do so. On Thursday, the federal government gave the officials, including the UN Deputy Humanitarian Chief, the Deputy Humanitarian Coordinator, and the UNICEF representative, 72 hours to leave Ethiopia. The UN said Monday that they had left amid concerns about their safety. UN spokesman Farhan Haq said, quote, "We stand by the neutrality and the even-handedness and professionalism of our staff," unquote. The World Food Programme warns food insecurity and hunger are rising in northern Ethiopia as the conflict in Tigray spills over into neighboring regions. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The UN Food Agency reports it has completed the first round of food distributions in northern Ethiopia's Amhara and Afar provinces. The operation, which began in mid-August, has reached an estimated 300,000 people affected by the spread of the conflict in Tigray into their territories. However, the World Food Programme reports distributions in Tigray are lagging. It says trucks continue to be stuck in the Afar region and are unable to deliver enough crucial supplies for millions of Tigrayan civilians living under dire conditions. A UN analysis of the severity of food insecurity in June estimates up to 400,000 people in Tigray are on the verge of famine. WFP spokesman Thompson Fury says anecdotal reports from all three conflict-affected regions suggest food shortages are on the rise.
In Afar and Amhara, our teams have seen hundreds of thousands of people displaced from their homes. It is absolutely vital that we have the full cooperation and support of all parties to the conflict so that we can reach all affected populations with urgently needed food assistance before we have a humanitarian catastrophe on our hands across all of northern Ethiopia.
The United Nations reports thousands of people have been killed and millions forcibly displaced from their homes since November, when the conflict between the Ethiopian military and the Tigray People's Liberation Front began. The UN says an estimated 5.2 million people, or 90% of Tigray's population, needs humanitarian aid. Theory says WFP aims to reach nearly 3.5 million people across all three regions in the next round of food distributions. However, he acknowledges several obstacles stand in the way of reaching that goal.
The food pipeline in Tigray remains hand to mouth, with a multitude of issues affecting the free movement of convoys. Additionally, the vast majority of commercial trucks have not been able to return from Tigray, which has been one of the major impediments to the delivery of cargo, as we have struggled to convene convoys.
Fury notes a total of 637 trucks have managed to reach Tigray, carrying only 11% of the humanitarian aid needed in the region. He says to adequately feed the population, 100 trucks loaded with life-saving supplies must arrive every day into the beleaguered province. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Facebook, Instagram, and WhatsApp at least partially reconnected to the global internet yesterday, nearly 6 hours into an outage that powers the social media platform. Facebook says the outage was caused by a reconfiguration of its servers. So, how did the outage affect users in Africa, where millions depend on it for their business and a primary form of communication? Saine Merene is the editor-in-chief of Arkamba Times, a digital news platform targeting Gambians at home and in the diaspora. He joins International Edition's Jackson Bungani from Seattle in Washington.
So, Sani, thank you very much for joining us. When did you find out about the outage, and how did you find out?
I wake up as early as 5 a.m., and then I start receiving messages from my family back home in Gambia, West Africa. Moments, an hour later, I couldn't reply, neither can I send messages back to those who were texting me. So I had to restart my phone twice because it's very unusual. I noticed it first from my WhatsApp messaging. Then I went back to my Facebook. I checked it. The Facebook couldn't load. I had to call my operator, that is T-Mobile, to ask them whether my internet has been cut down or my internet has been shut down. But right. I realized it has nothing to do with my internet. It has to do with Facebook, global Facebook shutdown.
So, Sene, how did it affect your work? How often do you use these platforms?
It has seriously affected my work because my social media platforms, that is the Facebook, the Twitter, and the WhatsApp, are all linked to my website. Moments I publish my stories, it feeds my social media platform. So today I have a very important story. You may hear about a U.S. government, you know, confiscating the property of the former president of the Gambia, Yahya Jammeh. So I had an interview with activists who were calling for the U.S. seizure of those properties. So I published that story, but I couldn't have traffic. I was like, what's going on? Normally, if I write stories like that, I get a lot of traffic. People will be reading. But I realized no one was reading because my traffic was generated on this social media platform. That's Twitter, Facebook, and WhatsApp, you know.
Of the three platforms, which one do you think had the most impact? Which of the three is the most used in Gambia or in West Africa in general?
Generally, Facebook and WhatsApp are the most widely used platforms.
What do they use these platforms for?
No, they use Facebook to communicate with families and friends. Others, including myself, use it for business. And WhatsApp, you know, has been a great medium of communication in the Gambia. If you remember 2016 presidential election in the Gambia, WhatsApp was the platform that politicians, ordinary electorate, communicate with, you know, they communicate among themselves to sell their messages or to receive information from, you know, political parties. So WhatsApp is widely used in the Gambia. I can say it's more widely used than Facebook because even those our grandmas and our grandpas can record their voice or listen to these audio messages, just a click. So it has serious impact on my work as a digital journalist who is supplying information to my people in Gambia and elsewhere.
That was Sine Marane, editor-in-chief of Akamba Times, a digital news platform, speaking with International Edition's Jackson Vungani. The outage was the second blow to the social media giant after a whistleblower on Sunday accused the company of repeatedly prioritizing profit over clamping down on hate speech and misinformation. There are growing fears that a fourth wave of COVID-19 could arrive early in South Africa as campaigning intensifies for local government elections in 4 weeks. The country recently announced it has exited the third wave of the coronavirus as daily infections have fallen from a peak of 20,000 to below 2,000, but experts caution the large political gatherings could reverse the progress. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
Political parties are out in full force to pursue votes, with hundreds of political parties holding rallies and door-to-door campaigns over the weekend. President Cyril Ramaphosa, who heads the ruling African National Congress, ANC, was in the Eastern Cape province where hundreds gathered to listen to him. The Economic Freedom Fighters EFF leader Julius Malema was in his home province of Limpopo where he wooed thousands. With over 300 parties contesting the polls, these are scenes likely to dominate cities and villages till the eve of the election, and health experts are worried. Nicholas Crisp is acting director general in the Department of Health.
We just really got to encourage people to preferably not get involved in the large crowds, but where they do, stay far apart from one another and preferably stay in outdoor spaces, not in the indoor spaces.
Dr. Jorgen Pillay from the Clinton Health Access warns against any actions that could spread the coronavirus ahead of the fourth wave, which is predicted to hit the country in December.
One of the key things we need to do in order not to be complacent is to ensure that we practice all of the non-pharmaceutical interventions, and we know all of those things, hand washing, masking, social distancing, and good ventilation. And now that it's summer, we can keep our windows open, and more likely to do that than in winter.
But EFF leader Julius Malema whose party opposed halting the polls during a pandemic, says those who declared the election dates should have known better.
There is what we call an election mood. We need to build an election mood to make election exciting, to make people look forward to voting, and we cannot do that if there is no festivities, if there are no rallies, if there are no mass mobilizations to make sure that there is indeed excitement, because any other method will lead to voter apathy.
The government has allowed gatherings with a maximum of 2,000 people, but some rallies are exceeding this number. Close to 3 million people have tested positive for the coronavirus in South Africa, making it the worst hit country on the African continent. Over 87,000 have died. 9 million people have been fully vaccinated out of the 60 million population. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta says an investigation exposing global leaders' use of tax havens will, quote, enhance financial transparency, unquote, but did not comment on allegations that his family owns offshore companies. On Sunday, the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists published the, quote, Pandora Papers, unquote, a report based on leaks of millions of secret financial documents that reveals a hidden world of wealth belonging to hundreds of politicians and billionaires. The investigation shows that Kenyatta and his family own 11 offshore companies with total assets of more than $30 million. Kenyatta said yesterday that releasing the Pandora Papers will help advance the openness that, quote, we require in Kenya and around the globe, unquote. He said the movement of illicit funds thrives, quote, in an environment of secrecy and darkness, unquote. The ICIJ report does not indicate that the Kenyatta family acted illegally or that the offshore assets were acquired during his presidency. The Kenyattans are one of the wealthiest families in Africa, with investments in farming, dairy production, banking, and real estate. Most of that was acquired before Uhuru Kenyatta, son of the country's first president, Jomo Kenyatta, took office. Teachers in Cameroon are calling for better protection from separatists and terrorist attacks. Cameroon's teachers say too many of their colleagues have been forced to flee from rebels in the country's western regions and Boko Haram terrorists along the northern border with Nigeria. Moki Edward Kinzeka reports from the capital, Yaounde.
The song "Old Teachers" by Cameroonian singer Antiklo blasted through speakers Tuesday at Yaounde City Council courtyard, with about 200 teachers listening. Antiklo's lyrics are about how teachers should be respected and protected, as they are the ones tasked with molding young minds for the future and Cameroon's development. Most of the teachers attending the protest held to mark the UN-declared World Teachers' Day say they fled the Boko Haram insurgency in the north, or fighting between the government and English-speaking separatists in the West. 52-year-old Peter Ta, a spokesperson for the teachers, says instructors working in Cameroon's conflict zones endure a lot of suffering.
Teachers are being persecuted every day, every hour. Some have been brutally killed, others brutally deprived of some parts of their bodies, forced out of their areas to become internally displaced persons. Some are now jobless. My heart bleeds for these teachers. I pray peace should return.
Taz said he escaped from a government school in the town of Ndop after separatist fighters kidnapped him. The protest was organized by the Cameroon Association of Teachers in Crisis. Ta said the teachers want the international community to know that they are suffering. More than 40 teachers have been killed in Cameroon since 2017. More than 300 others were abducted and freed only after their families paid ransom. Hundreds of schools in the north and west were destroyed or shut down. Valentine Tame is president of the Teachers Association of Cameroon. He says teachers sometimes have no option but to flee the violence.
It becomes really a sorry spectacle, seeing teachers running with their families, some losing their lives, some fleeing to areas where they cannot do anything to sustain themselves. We're appealing that everyone who is engaged in a kind of war should understand that teachers and the milieu in which they operate are sacrosanct, and fighters should understand that without teachers, the community is preparing for a kind of dark ages.
Cameroon's Minister of Basic Education, Laurent Serge Etuningwa, says the military is protecting schools, teachers and school children in regions where there is a security crisis. He encouraged teachers who fled insecurity to return to relatively peaceful areas for the sake of the children in need of education.
We just recruited 5,000 teachers to support those who have been already in the field. When you go to teach in a region of Cameroon, you must know that it's your country. The children who are there are all our sons and daughters. So we have to do everything necessary for them to have a safe education, because they are the actors who tomorrow will continue building Cameroon.
The United Nations declared October 5 as World Teachers' Day in 1994. To honor teachers for the important role they play in economic development and other sectors through education. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
In Malawi, a businessman has been ordered to spend 9 years in prison for trying to bribe constitutional court judges who were handling a case in which opposition parties disputed results. Opposition parties disputed results of the 2019 election, won by President Peter Mutharika. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
The sentence comes 2 weeks after the court convicted Tom Mpinganjira. High Court Judge Dorothy De Gabriel pronounced the sentence Tuesday.
This court imposes a custodial sentence of 9 years imprisonment with hard labor on the first count and 9 years imprisonment with hard labor on the fourth count. Since the offenses were committed in one transaction, the sentence will run concurrently.
The Malawi Anti-Corruption Bureau arrested Mpinganjira in January 2020 for trying to offer judges an unspecified amount of money to rule in favor of the then president Peter Mutharika. Mpinganjira denied the charges. However, during conviction last month, the court said it proved beyond a reasonable doubt that Mpinganjira wanted to bribe the five judges. Lawyer for the Anti-Corruption Bureau, Victor Chiwala, welcomed the sentence, saying it removed the notion that prisons are only for the poor.
But with this sentence, it has shown that as Malawi, we are upholding the rule of law. No one is above the law. And Mr. Mpinganjira, being a rich man, as worth as he is, has been sentenced and he'll be going to jail for 9 years.
Patrice Nkono is one of Mpinganjira's lawyers. He told the reporters that the conviction and the sentence will be appealed.
I cannot say much detail now. We then need to do the documents, but also the taking of instructions with client. And I think the rest of it will become much clearer going forward. But obviously, the point is that we're not satisfied with the conviction. And we also think that the sentencing is, in any event, excessive.
Mpinganjira's lawyer asked the court to consider non-custodial punishment, saying his client is a first offender, but Judge De Gabriel said the custodial sentence is aimed at reforming the offender and preventing others from committing similar crimes. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
Sudanese officials say security forces have killed four suspected Islamic State group militants in raids on their hideouts in the capital Khartoum. A military officer also was killed and three others wounded. Four suspected militants were arrested. Monday's raid took place in the same Gabra neighborhood in southern Khartoum, where five intelligence officials were killed last week in a shootout with suspected IS militants. Militant attacks have been rare in Sudan. Latest incidents, however, underscore the challenges as Sudan transitions to democracy more than 2 years after the military overthrew longtime leader Omar al-Bashir during a mass public uprising against his three-decade rule. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I am Chinedu Afua in Washington. For all latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. And thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.